Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 13th episode. Wild Trekker is a series of 50-minute podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. That's one of my musical compositions, Gerlache's Nightmare and Violin Effects Experiment. I admit it's kind of freaky. I did it for my forthcoming feature film on polar exploration, The Blinding Sea. Anyway, that's just to set the tone for today's podcast, which is all about the future. The future, we know, bears bold promise, but also brooding technological challenges. The podcast is an interview I did several years ago with an amazing American inventor and futurist, Ray Kurzweil. Ray has written a few books, such as The Age of Intelligent Machines and The Age of Spiritual Machines. He's revolutionized our understanding of optical character recognition, text-to-speech synthesis, speech recognition, and electronic keyboard instruments. Ray has made an enormous contribution to artificial intelligence. And he has created, then sold, a series of cutting-edge technology companies over the years. I met him just west of Boston, Massachusetts. Do you think that people are afraid of computers as machines because they might overcome us, or are people afraid of novelty?
Well, I think people have a negative view of what a machine can do because all the machines we've ever met are on the order of a million times simpler than humans, so they seem rather trivial compared to the subtlety and depth of humans. And so to compare a human to machine, we take that as somewhat of an insult. But that's really underestimating the capacity and the subtlety and the complexity of machines that we will meet some decades hence. If you look at what's happening in the human brain, If you look at what's happening in the human brain, it is understandable in mathematical terms. In fact, we have mathematical models of different regions of the brain already. We're in a very early stage of understanding how the brain works, but the process of reverse engineering the brain, understanding its principles of operation, is well underway. It's maybe where the Genome Project was 15 years ago. And ultimately, we will understand the brain and the body as a very complex machine. And if we were to recreate those basic principles using perhaps other materials, for example, our electronic circuits are already 10 to 100 million times faster than our interneuronal circuits in our brains. If we were to recreate those methods, we would get very similar behavior. It becomes a deeply philosophical question whether an entity that then acted human because it was based on the same principles was in fact conscious or just simulating a conscious process. In my view, that's not something we can actually answer through experimentation. That's not a scientific question. It's not to say it's not a real question. But in terms of behavior, in terms of intelligent interaction with its environment, we will have machines that match that of humans, indeed are based on the same principles of operation and that are result from our reverse engineering or understanding the principles of operation of the brain. And these entities will be human-like, but they will really be an expression of our human civilization. And ultimately, the primary application of this technology will literally be to expand our own intelligence. We're going to be putting these in our bodies and brains, as we're already beginning to do, and expanding the power of the human civilization. We're already well down that path.
Do you see any reason for some people to feel inadequate compared to increasingly powerful machines, computers, or do you feel that they just haven't seen how their own potential could be extended by computer technology?
I think relevant to that question is another question, which is what does it mean to be human? And some people would describe human as having very specific traits and shapes and genetic code and that have to do with us as an animal species. But in my mind, being human is specifically that species that seeks to extend its horizons, seeks to extend its abilities, seeks to go beyond its limitations. We didn't stay on the ground. We didn't stay on our planet. We didn't stay with an average lifespan of 37 years, which was life expectancy 200 years ago. We are not today staying with the limitations of our human biology. We're constantly expanding what we can do and who we are. And we're already tinkering with, either chemically or with machines, virtually every system in our bodies and beginning to do that with our brains. And if you go forward a few decades, we will really re-engineer our bodies and brains. They'll still be human, but we're going to become more human. I mean, not all of us can create music like Beethoven did. Beethoven was a human. He created music, but we can't do that. But why can't we? Why not have greater creative abilities and greater powers of pattern recognition? And so we're going to become actually more of what is uniquely human, become better masters of our emotions and so on through understanding who we are and then actually extending human thinking capacity by an intimate merger with our technology.
The image of man the machine, the idea, the metaphor, goes back at least to the Italian Renaissance in the person of Leonardo da Vinci, but it could also be traced back to Plato and perhaps further still to the pre-Socratics. In a way, it's a challenge to us because when people began to speak of comparing humans to machines, machines were relatively unsophisticated. But now, in some ways, we may seem to be the losing end of the equation as machines surpass human intelligence, and indeed it's something that you've mentioned quite often in your writings.
Right. Machines still today are significantly inferior to humans. I mean, even our most complex computers are on the order of a million times simpler than the human brain appears to be. And the human brain has some very unique qualities of being massively parallel and self-organizing and so on. But we can use those same principles with our technology. And one thing to keep in mind is that our biological intelligence is fixed. We have, by my estimate, about 10 to the 26 power calculations per second in all roughly 10 billion human brains on Earth. 50 years from now, that figure will still be 10 to the 26 power. Our non-biological intelligence right now is a million times less than that. So it appears correctly that human intelligence still dominates. But machine intelligence is doubling every year or even growing even faster than that. And the crossover point will be in the 2020s. So when you get to the 2030s, non-biological intelligence will be greater than that of human intelligence. We'll have properties that we don't have, like the ability to instantly share knowledge and remember, you know, billions of things accurately and so on, and combine that with the subtleties of human intelligence. But it's not, in my view, an alien invasion of intelligent machines coming from over the horizon to compete with us. It's emerging from within our civilization, and it's going to literally be inside our bodies and brains, intimately communicating with our biological circuits and creating a very intimate hybrid. You talk to somebody in 2035, a normal biological person with a mother and father, you'll be actually interacting with someone who has profound biological and non-biological processes going on in their brains and bodies, and be a very intimate hybrid. And that person will be more intelligent, more capable, because of that non-biological aspect.
Could we take this from the realm of general ideas and be more specific? Do you see the kind of artificial intelligence that you're telling me about as something that could be applied to help, for example, mentally retarded people?
Right now, we're using computer technology to level the playing field with a number of disabilities, technologies such as reading machines, speech recognition, different types of prosthetic aids are gradually overcoming the handicaps associated with sensory disabilities like blindness and deafness and paraplegia and so on. There's technology that some of which I've been involved in that helps overcome learning disabilities and reading disabilities. If we talk about very pervasive issues like retardation, that's more difficult because it's not a sort of simple, localized disability. The original origin of it may be very localized, but then over time, it'll have a significant impact on that whole person's intellectual history, ability to acquire knowledge, and so on. But basically, yes, I think once we understand how the human brain works and we see exactly what's going wrong with any of these significant conditions, some of which are very simple defects, some of which are more complex and more pervasive, we will have the means of overcoming them. And so my point is that this technology is already leveling the playing field in terms of overcoming disabilities, and it will have even more profound effect when we really understand how human intelligence works.
When I was in Britain not long ago, I interviewed Graham Richards, who's chairman of the chemistry department at Oxford, and he drew inspiration from SETI to develop a distributed computing project which is looking for a cure for cancer. It uses screensaver time on 1.7 million PCs and growing, and is looking at 3.5 billion molecules to see which ones under certain conditions might be appropriate for further study as in drug development. What do you think about this type of use of distributed computing, which does involve, I think, some artificial intelligence?
Well, distributed computing is very much the wave of the future. Right now we have some limitations because the bandwidth of our connection to the internet is generally quite low, but as we get ubiquitous high bandwidth and even higher than broadband today, what we're going to really see is people not so much using computers but plugging into this sort of worldwide fabric of computing. And if somebody needs a lot of computing, they'll have it available, and if they don't need a lot, they'll use whatever they need. Right now, 99% of the capacity of computers lies unused. I mean, probably at any one point in time, 98% of the computers aren't used at all. And even the ones that are used aren't used very much. So the vast majority of the computational resources are kind of being unused at any one point in time. And our brain does work this way. Our brain does not work sequentially one step at a time the way our computers do. We have 100 trillion connections that are all potentially computing simultaneously. So despite the fact that the brain actually uses a very cumbersome electrochemical signaling technique that is 10 million times slower than electronic circuits, it makes up for it because of this sort of massive parallelism. And ultimately, that's what the internet is going to evolve into.
Graham Richards says that he has created the world's largest supercomputer at no cost to Oxford University and at no cost to the individual owners of these 1.7 million or 2 million personal computers. Is this a new kind of machine that we'll be seeing increasingly in the future?
This is a trend of sharing resources so that we can actually make use of all the computers that are either not used at any one point in time or underutilized. And this is going to evolve to the point where the internet really is a fabric of computational resources. And if you need a massive supercomputer of a billion processors for 3 seconds, you'll have that available. It'll be a much more flexible type of system. And it's one way in which we'll get the computational resources to emulate human intelligence. I estimate that one human brain has a capacity of about 20 billion MIPS. That's a conservatively high estimate. We'll have 20 billion MIPS for about $1,000 in the year 2020. But this type of distributed computing, where we're harvesting unused computational resources on the internet, will actually accelerate that date.
Sir John Sulston, the former director of the Human Genome Project in the UK, at the British end, and who recently won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, told me that without computers, it would never have been possible to undertake a project of this scope. And he said, and moreover, the Human Genome Project is just a beginning, because now that we are cataloging the genes in the genome and the DNA bases, we now have to go on to study the functions. How do you see the role of artificial intelligence in helping us to understand the functions of genes and the proteome as well?
Right. Well, there was a lot of skepticism 15 years ago that we could decode the genome in 15 years, because at the rate at which they could sequence DNA at that time, it would have taken 10,000 years to finish the project. And what people very often don't take into consideration is that many different technologies are all accelerating at the same time, and one technology in one area will affect another area. And certainly the Genome Project and finding the boundaries of different genes and so on would have been impossible without the pattern recognition capabilities of today's computers. And the next step, which is how the genome expresses itself in proteins, which is called the proteome, is even more complex. But we're going to have even more powerful computers to deal with that. And it's going to be a very profound revolution in our ability to understand life and disease processes. And I believe within 10 years, we will be adding more than a year every year to human life expectancy as we really start to reap the fruits of the biotechnology revolution.
Now, the Turing test is a common expression of the Turing test is that we are faced with a machine, a human foil, and there's a judge who doesn't know the difference between them, and the machine convinces us that it is so like a human that we won't really be able to tell it's just a machine. In your book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, you were careful to say that by a certain date, machines will convince us that they're spiritual. Are you framing it in terms of the Turing test?
Well, yes, I think the Turing test actually is a very good test, and it has withstood the test of time as a good test for human-level intelligence. Nobody's come up with a better one, and I think Turing's brilliant insight is that human intelligence is and can be manifested in language. And an entity, simply through text messages, as in this sort of instant messaging type test, if a machine can convince us that it's human through its use of written language and these types of dialogues, then it really is operating at human levels. There's no sort of simple trick that is simpler than human intelligence that would allow a machine or any entity to pass a properly designed Turing test. And I think that is true. So I think once a machine really passes a legitimate Turing test, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of false reports before that happens, but once it really does happen, machines will be operating at a human level. They'll then be able to combine the sort of human subtlety and suppleness of intelligence and flexibility with ways in which machines are already superior. namely ability to remember billions of things accurately, tremendous speed, and also the ability to instantly share knowledge. Now, a key to really emulating human intelligence is emulating human emotional intelligence, the ability to perceive and respond appropriately to emotion, to be enthusiastic, to be funny, to get the joke, to understand fear and all the different human emotions, and act emotional. Emotion is not something stuck on the side of human intelligence. In my view, it's the cutting edge. It's the most complex, most subtle, deepest thing that we do. And a machine won't be able to pass the Turing test until it really masters that. Once it does, you'll have a machine that'll claim to be conscious. And unlike claims today, because you could have a machine that just made a claim to be conscious, but it wouldn't be very convincing today. But in the future, 2029, those claims will be convincing. And you'll have an entity that really can convince us that it is conscious, and that it's happy, joyful, fearful, so whatever. And my prediction, and it's not a philosophical prediction, it's really a political and psychological prediction, is that most people will believe those claims. For one thing, the machines will get mad at us if we don't believe them, and they'll be very, very smart, so they'll be able to convince us. But it still leaves the really fundamental philosophical question, is it really conscious? Is there really somebody home, or is this just an incredibly sophisticated simulation of a person who's conscious, but it's really not conscious? And my contention is that there's no scientific test that can answer that question. There's no machine that you could slide an entity into and a green light comes on. Okay, this entity is conscious. No, this one isn't. That doesn't have some assumptions built into it. And we have these arguments today. I mean, we may agree that most humans who seem to be conscious are conscious, but that human consensus breaks down when you go outside of human experience. They talk about animals. There's genuine disagreement. Some people say, oh, no, dogs and cats and other higher level animals are conscious because we see behaviors that remind us of human behaviors, fear and joy for their and protection of their young and so on. Other people say, no, animals just operate by instinct, which means a simple machine-like response, and they're not conscious. And you can't be conscious unless you master human-level language. We'll have the same issue with machines, only the machines will actually be more human than animals, because animals aren't quite human. But the machines ultimately will be, as human as humans are. But some philosophers will come and say, no, it's not squirting human neurotransmitters, and you can't be human, you can't be conscious unless you squirt biological neurotransmitters. There's no ultimate philosophical test or scientific test that can answer this question, which is why we have a proper realm for philosophy and religion, which is really the field that answers these questions. But my prediction, and it's really kind of a political prediction, is that the bulk of human opinion will come to accept this, partly because humans are going to become partly machine, and ultimately the dominant portion of our thinking will be machines. Since we're going to have machine processes inside us, there's not going to be any clear distinction between human and machine intelligence. You won't be able to say, okay, humans on the left side of the room, machines on the right, because it's going to be all mixed up.
Over 300 years ago, Leibniz, a great philosopher, metaphysician, universal man, also an inventor of calculators, which are like precursors to today's computers, he wrote, by means of the soul or form, there is in us a true unity which corresponds to what I call I. This can have no place in artificial machines or in a simple mass of matter, however organized it may be. The way I see that, the way I read that is that Leibniz is saying there's something particular to humans in the unity of soul and form which will never be replicated in machines.
Well, I think the machines will disagree, and they will be very convincing because they'll be very smart, and they will be emotional, and they'll be able to and they will be part of human discourse because there's not going to be a clear distinction between humans and machines. Humans are going to have machine processes inside them. Machines You could have a machine that's completely non-biological, but it'll be based on the reverse engineering of human intelligence, and so it'll be very human-like. And it's all going to be very deeply integrated together into one human-machine civilization. We already have a human-machine civilization. If all the machines stop today, our civilization will grind to a halt. So, you know, we don't absolutely know that anybody is conscious aside from ourselves. I mean, I don't know that anybody's conscious besides myself, and maybe everything I encounter, all other people are just dreams. I certainly do encounter people in my dreams that seem like real other people, and then I wake up and realize, oh, that person doesn't really exist. It was just in my head. Well, maybe everybody's just in my head. Maybe there's just one head, because some religions say that we're all part of the same consciousness. It's just one consciousness. So these are very important issues. The bottom line, though, is that if you talk about the behavior of an entity, like a human, what they do and say and how they react to their environment and their emotional outbursts and so on, it's all a result of what's going on in their bodies and brains. And some people have said, oh, well, it's so complex, it's beyond our ability to understand. And what we're discovering is that that's not the case, that when we can actually see what's going on, as we're beginning to, it's an early stage yet, we actually can develop mathematical models and understand what's going on. We have very detailed models of neurons and of neural clusters, and it is amenable to our scientific process.
In the Age of Spiritual Machines, I'm not sure, when reading The Age of Spiritual Machines, I wasn't quite sure what you meant by spiritual, and I wasn't sure how this term could be applied to inanimate matter. Whereas spiritual, for most people, is related to spirituality or spiritual experience or religious experience.
There's two implications. The most important one is the ultimate spiritual value is consciousness. Sometimes it's called the soul, the I that you just referred to in the Leibniz quote. But an entity is actually conscious, aware of its experience. That is a spiritual quality. That's the sort of intuitive idea that separates a simple machine from a person. This person has feelings, but the feelings are not just a mechanical thing. They're actually experienced in a conscious way. That's the ultimate spirituality. And we will have machines in the future that claim to be conscious, to actually feel their feelings and not just react in a simulated way, but are actually feeling the emotions they appear to be displaying. And their claims will be convincing because they'll have all the subtle cues and complex rich behavior that we associate with actually experiencing these emotions. And then we get down to this deeply philosophical question, that robot or that virtual reality personality really did seem convincing and really did seem angry. Is that entity really experiencing that as it appears to be, or is it just a simulation? There's going to be no fundamental way of answering that question. And I believe that we will come to accept that these entities really are conscious. And again, that's a political and psychological prediction. There's actually no scientific way of ever demonstrating that another entity is conscious. It comes down to the basic difference between objective measurement, which is science, and subjective experience, which is consciousness. And there's really no way to bridge that gap without making some basic assumptions as to what constitutes consciousness. But I believe that these entities will have the complexity and richness of human thought. They will enter, we're in the early stages of that process, they'll enter the human dialogue. And they're going to be part of our civilization. And they're going to be part of what we consider to be spiritual beings. The other aspect of spirituality is that, in my mind, evolution is a spiritual process. The term God is an ideal that refers to infinite beauty, all-knowing, infinite creativity, infinite intelligence. And if we look at what happens to entities as they undergo evolution, they become more intelligent, more creative, more beautiful, more emotional, more knowledgeable over time as they evolve. And in fact, these qualities grow exponentially over time. They never become infinite, so we never become literally God, but we're moving in that direction at an exponential pace. So evolution is a spiritual process, and technology is a continuation of the biological process that gave rise to the technology creating species in the first place. And the next stage in evolution is going to be us merging with our technology and really expanding human intelligence and human ability to create beauty and human creativity. So that's the next stage in evolution. And in my mind, that's a fundamentally spiritual step.
If computers significantly surpass human intelligence within, say, 3 decades, if artificial intelligence has obviously very beneficial applications in the form of dealing with disabilities, helping people to manage with different disabilities, the applications of artificial intelligence are very significant today in medicine. Isn't there also a possibility that some decades hence, artificial intelligence could be used to manipulate people, to control, to invade their privacy, to keep them under constant watch in a Big Brother kind of way?
Well, technology is power, and it can be used to amplify our creative instincts. It can also be used to amplify our destructive side of our nature. We've already seen that. We've certainly seen a lot of that in the 20th century. And the new technologies of the 21st century are going to be even more powerful, vastly more powerful than those of the 20th century. And that's true of both the creative aspects of being able to overcome disease and disability and expand our well-being, our longevity, our ability to be creative, express ourselves, but also our ability to be destructive. And I think I do see that as a primary challenge of the 21st century. We already do very private things on our personal computers, and there's already great concern with people being able to set little software programs that act as spies on what we're doing in our personal computers and which websites we go to and what we do on those websites. And when we have computers running in our bodies and brains, things like software viruses and software spying programs and so on become even more of greater concern. I do think if you look at the balance of power in, say, the software world, the viruses and these other destructive software programs versus our attempts to protect ourselves from them, the benefits are still outweighing the damage. Nobody's suggesting, well, let's do away with the internet because of the destructiveness of software viruses. But software viruses do cause a lot of destruction, but we've been able to keep the destruction at a small fraction of the benefit. But we can never really rest easy. It's always, the viruses and other destructive software programs get more and more sophisticated, and we have to then create more and more sophisticated defenses. We're going to have to do the same thing in other areas of technology. The next big danger is bioengineered pathogens. The same technology that's going to save millions of lives from cancer and heart disease and extend human longevity and do a lot of very positive health and medical things can also be used by a terrorist to create a bioengineered pathogen, and there's already great concern about that. I mean, it's already possible, say, to take smallpox and modify it so the vaccine doesn't work. And there's 100 other scenarios like that that are feasible, maybe not easy. We have to really accelerate our defensive technologies, such as new antiviral drugs that are emerging. And I do have a concern there that we have regulatory processes that slow down the positive applications, but they don't slow down the destructive ones. If a terrorist wants to create a bioengineered pathogen, he doesn't have to put that through the FDA to get approval. He just goes and does it. Meanwhile, our antiviral drugs do have to go through the FDA, which tends to be a very slow and cumbersome and bureaucratic process. We're going to have to figure out how to accelerate our defensive technologies to keep pace with the ability of people to misapply these technologies. And I do see this as a big challenge. I tend to be an optimist. I think we will keep an edge on the constructive use of technology. I think that's what we've seen over the last 200 years. But if you describe today to people 200 years ago, they would, with all the destructive power we have, say enough nuclear weapons to destroy all life on the planet, people might think it mad to take such risks. But conversely, if you ask people today, do you want to go back to the way people lived 200 years ago? Okay, some people might naively say yes, but if you really describe what that means, average lifespan 37 years, 99% of the population living in poverty, tremendous labor-intensive, disease-prone, disaster-prone lives, few people would really want to go back. We really have liberated ourselves through technology while we also create profound new dangers. On balance, I think technology has helped us. It's not a simple argument. And that uneasy balance is going to grow more and more profound as our technologies grow more powerful.
If you think of Leonardo da Vinci as a universal man of his time, who was a master of art, pictorial art, sculpture, architecture, engineering, and even did musical notation, cartography, lots of other things. What do you think, as someone who's sort of used to these great leaps forward and prophecy, as it were, what do you think Leonardo, how he would react if he were parachuted into our world today and saw what artificial intelligence was becoming?
Well, I think he would be delighted at the power of the tools to be creative. And we went through one period where knowledge has become so specialized that people have to be very narrow. But now tools are really allowing people to broaden again. We have, for example, computer-assisted tools that allow people to express themselves artistically even if they don't have drawing skills. They do need to have some aesthetic, artistic sense, but they can express themselves visually. We're involved in developing some tools like that for music and art that will allow people to express themselves simply by having a critical faculty, but not necessarily the musical or artistic skills. So people can express themselves in a variety of ways, the way Leonardo did. There's tremendous new opportunities to new art forms that didn't exist before. I mean, just look at music, at all of the different technologies that allow people to express themselves. You can have one person, you know, one kid in his dorm room who can create a whole jazz or rock band or orchestra. You know, my father was a composer, and he couldn't hear his orchestral compositions without raising money and hiring an orchestra, which turned out to be very, very hard to ever do. And then if he didn't like it, he'd have to dismiss the orchestra and raise more money to hear a second version, whereas now you can create these very complex works just, you know, on your workstation in your living room.
Through your inventions, you've found many ways to help people with disabilities to deal with them or even to overcome them in some cases. You've helped blind people to read in a way, at least by having a computer read to them, giving them the power to replace one of the senses which they don't have. What is your deep-seated motivation in the work that you've done in artificial intelligence? What has driven you to invent so much, to write so much, to explain all the possible benefits so much?
Well, the exciting thing about inventing is the leap from sort of dry formulas on a blackboard to actual impact, positive impact on people's lives. And what's exciting for me is not just giving a demo and putting a device on a table and showing it to people, but actually having it become part of the fabric of people's lives. So it's really deeply satisfying to me when musicians can use our musical technology and create music they couldn't create before, or for blind person sends me a letter and says he got his college education and couldn't have done it without the reading machine and things like that. It's the ability of technology to make a positive impact on people's lives. And I do choose the projects I get involved in carefully to have some positive impact on our cultural, social, and humanitarian goals. In terms of writing, this really gives me the ability to invent with the technologies of the future. I've become a student of technology trends, partly as an outgrowth of being an inventor, because you have to make your inventions make sense when you finish the project, not just when you start the project. So I became a student of how technology evolves and develop mathematical models of technology, and it allows me to project where technology will be in 2010 or 2020. And then we can use our imagination to actually create inventions, scenarios of how technologies can be put together and have an impact on people's lives in the future. So while we can't build these machines yet, we can talk about them, and that's really been the purpose of my writings. So it's another way of being inventive. And then also being able to examine what life will be like so we can address the issues and try to reap the promise of technology while we manage the peril.
Are there things that you really still have as ambitions that you've not fulfilled yet?
Oh, I have lots of ideas and keep getting more ideas, and one idea suggests another. And my biggest problem is there's not enough hours in the day. And really, no matter how much resources one gets, there's just always more one wants to do. At least that's how I feel. So I've got lots of things I'm working on and hope to keep contributing. It gets more and more exciting because the technology gets more powerful. The development tools are more powerful, so you can do things more quickly with smaller teams, with less money. I mean, right now, you know, somebody could start a software company with, you know, $2,000 of equipment and a few people in their, you know, basement. That really is feasible. That wasn't feasible decades ago. So, you know, I'm continuing to pursue, you know, building technology that will have an impact.
And that's another of my musical compositions, which I call Upbeat Syncopated Piano Rendition of Scottish Theme with Violin Accompaniment, WTMA03. Okay, it's a crazy title for a piece of work. Well, it's something I composed for a radio documentary co-production I did several years ago for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and Radio-Canada. So, both in English and in French, and the series was called When the Machine Awakes. Alongside my piano in this piece is Catherine Halmisch on the violin. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wild Trekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And evidencia is the Latin word for evidence, so it's spelled E-V-I-D-E-N, as in normal, T-I-A, evidencia.net. You can also check out my Facebook page, which is called Evidencia Channel. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wild Trekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Trekker, accompanied by Pascal Desmeules on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Trekker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.